You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Jen White. As we've been hearing this hour, the issue of poverty in Michigan is expansive, but there are people trying to figure out how to fix the problem. We want to look at what's working and what more can be done. You can share your ideas by calling us at 866-255-2762 or find us on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. Do you feel we do enough as a society to help people move out of poverty? And what kinds of interventions do you think would have the most impact and why? Joining us now is Jim Crisp, Executive Director of the Michigan Community Action Agency Association, and Dr. Tim Reddy, Director of the Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations at Western Michigan University. Jim, Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Jim, I want to start with you. What kinds of interventions seem to be the most effective for low-income families?
Well, we offer what we call wraparound services. So if an individual were to come into a community action agency to seek assistance in a particular program, let's say energy assistance, our intake specialists are then able to work with those individuals and find out everything they qualify for, whether it's one of our programs that we have federal funding for, if it's a state program, or if there's another group in the area that might offer assistance. So the programs work. They all help. Whether it's enough or not usually depends on funding, as always. So.
Tim, do we see certain kinds of programs working for Michigan families specifically, something about our economy that families need a specific kind of help?
There's a lot of help that needs to be coming to Michigan families, particularly in this economy. I think, as Jim mentioned, the kind of wraparound services that he mentioned are critical so that families in need don't have to go to agency A, B, C, D, and E in different parts of town to get different services, because it's the lived experience of families, of parents, and kids that matter. So I think that the wraparound concept is critical, and the other part that's critical, in my opinion, is getting low-income families as partners and getting them to buy in as partners in the process and getting them involved in the endeavor. And finally, I think reaching out to the general public to say, hey, it is in everybody's enlightened self-interest here that we cannot continue to allow the level of poverty that we have in our communities, particularly affecting our children.
Tim, speak a little bit more about the partnership aspect of what you just said.
Well, I think that one of the things that we're working on in Kalamazoo is engaging in low-income families in particular as partners in this endeavor. In Kalamazoo, as you may know, we have the Kalamazoo Promise Scholarship Program. It's a wonderful resource. We're really blessed to have this in our community. It provides a full college tuition to any public university or college in the state. The problem is that when you have a high-poverty school district, as we do in Kalamazoo and many other communities around the state, the challenge is to get kids to be able to first graduate and then to have the preparedness, the academic preparedness, to do well and to take advantage of that opportunity. And for that to happen, we're talking about the whole series of interventions from cradle to college and career that begin really prenatally. And there, as Sheldon was mentioning a second ago, disadvantages crop up very, very early in life. And by the time kids hit first grade, low-income kids are already well behind.
I want to hear from both of you. Do you think Michigan has been doing enough, the state itself, in providing support for low-income families? I'll start with you, Jim.
Quick answer is no. The long answer is that, they try to do what they can. They have to measure all aspects of running a state government. We feel, obviously, from our perspective, that more could be done. The latest run on low-income programs, such as the reduction of EITC and the like, has been a very negative impact on low-income people right when they need it the most. And that so often is the case, is when there's an economic downturn, that's when the funding seems to slip away as well, whether it's state funding or federal funding. And as a result, it just hits that much harder.
Tim?
Very few poor families receive cash assistance from the state or the federal government. I mean, that was cut out during the Clinton administration, and things have gotten worse. And the problem, again, particularly from my point of view, looking at the future of children, we are dramatically underinvesting in our kids. And when we allow kids to well over half of African American kids in the state to be growing up in poverty. And we want to have hold this ideal that everybody does have an equal shot to achieve. I wish it were true. There are always folks who overcome the odds and who make it, but there are a lot of things that a lot of people don't. And I think it's very short-sighted to be underinvesting in our kids this way.
You can join the conversation this afternoon at 866-255-2762. You can also join in on our live web chat at stateofopportunity.michiganradio.org. Let's take a call from Colleen in Lansing. Colleen, hi. What's your question?
Hi. I agree with your panelist. But instead of treating the cancer, so to say, I think we need to try and prevent it. And I think we need to look at programs that disincentivize young single mothers who maybe haven't finished their education having children, because I think generationally what happens is that they don't have the time or the resources to educate those children because they're so busy trying to make a living or just scrape by.
Colleen, let me ask you for a little point of clarification. When you say programs that incentivize young mothers, what do you mean by that?
What I mean is that when a young female gets pregnant, she has access to, food assistance, housing assistance, energy assistance. It basically, in some cases, becomes a way that they can, get out from under their parents' wing. And then there's, a lot of scholarships available to them and what have you, which is a great idea. However, we should make it so that when people have children at such a young age and without the experiences and you don't have a family unit that's too concrete, I think it leads to problems for the children. I mean, what we've seen is since the 60s, and, I'm no conservative, I'm actually a liberal, but it's that more and more children are in poverty and growing up in single-parent families, and single-parent families historically have a lower rate of income.
I think we have the gist of your question. I want to give Jim and Tim a chance to respond. Thank you so much, Colleen. So I think this is a concern for people, that there are programs that incentivize teenage pregnancy or young pregnancy. And how accurate is that? How close to the truth is that?
Jim, do you want to take on the program part of it? It doesn't seem that way to me.
Yeah, from a programmatic perspective, in our particular case, and I'll address the community action agencies again, which is who I work with. And from very early age, whether it's early Head Start or just a Head Start program, they work with children to try to give them a leg up, get them prepared so that when they do get into a regular elementary or a regular school setting, they are more socialized and ready. Because we've heard several of the speakers in your recorded spot talk about the disadvantages of being born into poverty. And with regards to the young families, there are programs out there that do address those. Quite often, it's up to the individual, though, to find those programs. We can't always find them. And I think that is part of the issue, is that the myriad of programs out there sometimes, and Tim kind of alluded to this as well, is that it's sometimes hard for people to work their way through that system. And so I think it's important that the programs that are available are made very clear to people early on. So,
Are there families that are on the bubble who are hovering just around the poverty line, so they're not able to access certain resources that would help them move ahead? Tim?
Sure, there are those families, and I think that issue about people who are just above the cutoff point for services, tends to engender, invidious, comparisons. They got this, and somebody else didn't get that. But the point of view, I think the bottom line is that the available services, as they say, cash assistance is almost rare. So few people get it. Getting back to the issue of single-parent families, the correlation of a child growing up in a single-parent family to poverty is extremely high. Correlation, however, is not necessarily causation. There's lots of factors that go into this, having to do with incentives for forming families and whether people feel that they have they're going to have the old-time mom-and-pop nuclear family or not, whether that makes sense. The correlation is huge. And I just want to put in a plug for a resource that we created at Western in collaboration with our colleagues at Grand Valley, the Community Research Institute. We created a website called myvoices.org, myvoices.org, where you can look up the demographics of poverty for communities throughout the state.
We know that these have been very difficult economic times, and you mentioned earlier, Jim, that the state, you think, is doing what it can right now. With that absence of state support, there's been a call for nonprofits to step up and fill the gap. But are they really able to keep up with the decline in state support that we're seeing?
Point of clarification, I didn't say they were doing all they could do. They make choices of what they want to do.
Pardon me.
And that's how they function, and that's their decisions to make. That's what we put them there for. Whether I agree with those decisions or not,
or not.
Are obviously up to debate, and I take care of that in November as best I can. So beyond that, certainly we're finding what we're calling now the new poor. I hate putting handles on people, but we've got the generational poor. We've got the new poor now, individuals that all this time we talked about, they perceive themselves as middle class. And in many respects, they were. And due to a loss of a job or an injury or whatever, they're no longer middle class. They're part of the new poor. And again, the economic downturn, we know this for a fact. People fall into that poverty level. They start losing homes. They lose their income. And so when the need is the greatest for support agencies such as ours, that's when the funding seems to also go down. And the two clash, obviously. We can't help all of those, even who we were helping before, trying to get them beyond that poverty level, let alone the huge number of new individuals falling into poverty levels.
So what happens then, Tim? Are people just lost?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question, how people cope in the face of inadequate resources. You know, working at the community level, you know, seems to be where the action is right now, because there have been so many cutbacks at the state level and in years past at the federal level as well, and who knows what's going to happen with the future of the federal budget. But, you know, the community level seems to be where the action is. And in our community in Kalamazoo, and certainly this is true around the country, kind of taking cues from the Harlem Children's Zone model that has gotten a lot of press, there is a lot of focus on aligning those community resources so that they better serve in an integrated way children and families in need. And again, the whole flip side of that, getting the whole community, the citizens, including low-income citizens, as partners in this endeavor.
You're listening to State of Opportunity here on Michigan Radio. We'd like you to join the conversation at 866-255-2762. We also have a live web chat that you can join in on at stateofopportunity.michiganradio.org. Let's hear from Rachel in Kalamazoo. Rachel, what's your question?
Yes, I know there's some programs that clearly work and help parents break the end of poverty cycles. And I've been a member of some of these Western myself, and I was wondering why they're not implemented throughout the state if we have good data and research that these programs definitely work and help the students.
Thank you, Rachel, and I'm thinking that the answer there may be money. Jim, I'll go to you.
Well, I mean, that's the easy answer. The other thing is, and one of the unique parts of community action agencies, for instance, of which there are 30 and they serve the 83 counties of Michigan, is that they're all allowed to have an independence to respond to those that they serve. So the need in Kalamazoo, you may find some successful programs there which have no relevance whatsoever in Marquette or Detroit or Traverse City or Alpena or any of those. So it's important that, you know, they're allowed to develop programs based on the need of those that they serve in the area they're coming from. And geographically, there are many changes. And I would like to put a note in there that Tim has mentioned, too, that, you know, you need to get the low-income individuals involved. Our community action agencies all have a board of directors. It's a tripartite board, and one-third of that are individuals that are actually involved in the program. So they do have a voice, you know, starting right at the top of the chain with regards to community action and what they do.
I want to get to this question of personal responsibility. We hear people say that government programs prevent people from learning to be independent, and there's abuse of programs. When we talk about partnership and personal responsibility, how do we make a distinction between that? and this idea of pulling yourselves up by your bootstraps, that you can do it on your own. Tim?
I think that the key to in answering that question is making sure that children and their parents have a realistic hope that what they do on a day-to-day basis is going to lead to some good outcome. I think one of the problems is that, particularly looking at it from the point of view of kids, is that, you know, kids start out in elementary school all wanting to succeed and do all the right things that that is expected to fulfill the American dream, as, you know, as we understand it. You know, and as they go through school, a lot of those disadvantages that are associated with poverty start accumulating and create disadvantages in terms of education outcomes, and they start getting proverbially beaten on the head for not doing well, and it's a whole lot easier to divert one's attention from doing well in school, you know, when you keep getting that negative feedback, and it's kind of the accumulation of all of those environmental factors that put you at disadvantage. So is it one or the other? Is it the sort of the cultural issues, or is it the disadvantages? And I think it's both, and you can't work on one without the other, would be my position.
Jim, if there was, if there is a key intervention, one place where you think the state nonprofit organizations really need to focus their attention to turn the tide, where would that be?
Well, I think all indications have been that, you know, they have to get to the family early. And I mean family, not just, you know, certainly it's important to take care of our children. It's also important to take care of our senior citizens. I think the key is to get to the family early when we see problems developing and solve them then, not wait for it to become a crisis. And so much of what we do and so many of our programs that we are offered say that they have to be in crisis before we can help them. Well, they're in crisis immediately, not, you know, when they get their utilities shut off or whatever. So I think an important aspect would be to get to them early, turn it around before it becomes a crisis.
Tim, we've got about 30 seconds.
I guess the one point I'd like to make is that our public discourse on poverty, particularly as it relates to kids, has focused overwhelmingly in recent years on schools. And teachers are either the goats or the heroes. And teachers can make a huge difference, no question about it. But there's so much more going on. And all the studies over the years suggest that what happens out of school matters probably more than what happens in school.
We've been speaking with Jim Crisp. He's executive director of the Michigan Community Action Agency Association, and Dr. Tim Reddy, director of the Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations at Western Michigan University. Thanks to you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a story to share about what it's like to grow up or raise kids in Michigan while struggling to pay the bills, we want to hear from you. Be a resource for this project by going to the State of Opportunity website. Click on the Share Your Story link. State of Opportunity was produced and directed by Zoe Clark, engineered by Bob Scon. We had assistance from Mercedes Mejia and Allie Billings. Tamar Charney is the executive producer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jennifer White.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.